Funding for Think is made possible by SMU Continuing and Professional Education.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. How do the real lives of Iranians compare with the image many Americans have in their minds? Humam Majd has always understood the limitations of modern American perceptions of Iran. He was born there, although he moved away with his diplomat father before he was a year old. As an adult journalist, he had visited the country and written extensively about Iranian politics and Persian culture. But a few years ago, he and his wife decided to make a bold move. They would move to Tehran and live there for a year along with their infant son. The latest book by journalist Humam Majd is called The Ministry of Guidance Invites You to Not Stay. It's now available in paperback. Humam, welcome to Think.
Oh, thank you very much. Thank you for having me.
What was the longest amount of time that you'd spent in Iran as an adult before you made this decision that you wanted to really set up home there?
I think probably 6 weeks. When I wrote my first book, I probably spent about 6 weeks researching it in Iran. But I realized very quickly that in order to really understand Iran or really understand both the culture and the politics, you kind of have to live there and have to deal with the same things that everyone else deals with. Now, say, you know, that said, obviously, as an American with an American passport, I always have the option of leaving, which most Iranians don't have. So being aware of that fact, it's still means a lot to live among a people, I think, as opposed to just visiting, even as a journalist, and trying to understand a society.
I really liked reading about your wife's response to this idea. She seems to have been not only open to the idea of sharing this experience with you, but in fact, she was kind of a driving force behind it.
I think so. I think, yes, and I guess I'm fortunate in that regard. I mean, in many mixed marriages, I guess. You know, some people are keen on learning about their husband or wife's, their better half's culture, and understanding more about where they come from and what forms them. And in some other cases, I guess people aren't interested, particularly in America, where every, you know, the great big melting pot where everybody kind of becomes, is you're supposed to become the same in many ways, or at least culturally the same, with some idiosyncrasies. But in my case, yes, there was this enthusiasm to understand that culture where her husband came from and which her son shares. But I think also there was this understanding that she had over the years of knowing me, that I had this great desire, and she always felt that without me actually doing that or really getting to understand my own roots in a way, and it sounds cliched, but that I would never be complete, and she wanted to share in that.
I think the United States is an interesting country because there are many people in your position, meaning that they are either children who were born, the first generation born in this country, or they came here when they were quite young.
Yes.
And people, I would imagine, before you had ever lived there, looked to you to be this expert on Iran. You felt that way compared to maybe some of your peers. On the other hand, if you were to think about cousins or whoever that you might have still living there, you had to recognize that you didn't know anything that would really help you to fully feel like you belong there.
Exactly. I mean, I also, I've always resisted the label expert because I actually don't think there are any experts. I think even people who work in the government of Iran or the government of the United States aren't really experts because it's a very difficult thing to be, to really understand a people, a political situation, and a culture. So I resisted that label, although as an Iranian-American, as someone who traveled there, as a journalist who had written about Iran, I guess I knew more than the average person did, or perhaps even the average Iranian-American who hasn't had that opportunity. But if you really want to get into it, yes, to really understand a culture, you have to live among the people. You have to be there. You have to understand what their daily lives are like and what it means to live there, what it means to think, I am living here, I have an apartment or a house or whatever your situation is, and the next morning I wake up, I will not be getting on a plane. I won't be getting on a plane 2 weeks from now, 3 weeks from now, 4 weeks from now. I will be living here and I have to make a life. And you see things through the eyes of other people. And again, as I said, I'm not, I don't want to exaggerate and say that I knew exactly what it meant to be Iranian and have the struggles that Iranians have to go through, especially today with sanctions on Iran that make life very difficult for many people, and particularly when it comes to medical supplies and foreign goods. So I didn't have those problems. And I don't have the problem of looking for a job, for example. But generally speaking, you do get a much better understanding, I feel, of what life is like for people.
How did the economic sanctions affect even the way that you had to manage your personal finances while you were there?
Well, I have family in Iran, so you can't wire money to Iran. You can't take, and they don't take credit cards in Iran because of the sanctions. Iranian banks can't work with American Express or Visa or MasterCard. So the only way, and journalists who go there, foreign journalists or who go there always take cash because you always have to spend cash. Of course, for a year's stay,
it's a lot of cash.
It's a lot of cash, yes. So, I just relied on my family who were there. So, again, I was fortunate that they have bank accounts. They have I did want to open a bank account, but some of my family have accounts overseas as well, so it was easy for me to reimburse them. But otherwise, I would have had to take cash, and figure out how much I would need for a year. So it's unfortunate. Unfortunately, a difficult situation financially, but doable.
So that was your situation. Talk about the effect of Western sanctions on just everyday people interacting in the Iranian economy.
Well, I mean, sanctions seem to be. We always think that sanctions are going to affect the government more than the people, and they don't. Unfortunately, it's the other way around. The government always finds a way, or any government finds a way to manage with income from whatever, however they have their income, whether it's oil or exports or whatever. Even with sanctions, they manage to have perhaps a black market. They find ways to get around it. Ordinary people have a much harder time. What sanctions mean is not just the unavailability of Western goods, because you could say there are Iranian goods or Chinese-made goods in Iran that are readily available. That's just one aspect. But what happens is the import-export business goes to a trickle, and that affects businesses who rely on import exports, and then they have to fire their employees or they have to downsize. And then you have inflation, which is caused by sanctions, a tremendous amount of inflation. You could actually see it in Iran almost on a daily basis. You know, they have outside banks and outside foreign exchange bureaus, they have these big TV monitors with a foreign exchange rate, and every day you see the Iranian money, Iranian currency losing value. Mm. And that affects people. Again, it affects businesses. And not being able to do international business, whether you're an insurance company, whether you're an automobile company, whatever your business is, it's greatly reduced when you have these kinds of so-called crippling sanctions, and that affects people's work. It affects their income. So joblessness was very high when I was in Iran, and it continued to go higher after even more stringent sanctions were imposed in 2012. So it affects everybody on a daily basis, and they're very, very well aware of these sanctions. Iranians are.
So are we naive to think if they have held out this long with sanctions that further action to harm the Iranian economy on the part of Western democracies will have the effect that we desire?
I'm not sure what the effect is that we desire. Some people argue that the effect is for the Iranian government or regime to stop their nuclear program or to halt the advance in their nuclear program. Others argue that a combination of that and potentially have the people rise up against the regime. Well, the second part is not going to happen, based on my experience. That's my view, that sanctions aren't going to get people to rise up against the regime and blame their own regime for the hardship. The first part, sure, sanctions are going to have some effect on how the government negotiates a nuclear treaty. I'm not sure if further sanctions beyond what exists today, and they are indeed very crippling sanctions. I mean, I don't think these kinds of sanctions, international sanctions, have been imposed on any country. It's almost an embargo. It's close to being an embargo. Yes, that will affect Iran's negotiating tactics, and I think they're going to be, as we can see with the election of the new president last year and with the negotiations over the past year and continuing now, with, at least with a deadline of November, that the Iranians have been much, much more conciliatory in terms of taking steps to assure the international community, and particularly the United States, I think, which is the most concerned party, that the nuclear program won't be used to make bombs.
What did it take for you to get the paperwork together to travel to Iran, and how much attention did you attract from the moment you arrived?
I think the attention was on me before I arrived. The paperwork is it's a bureaucracy like any other bureaucracy. The U.S.'s bureaucracy pales in comparison to Middle Eastern bureaucracies. Iran is quite efficient, but it is a bureaucracy. So getting passports and stuff like that, having been born in Iran, or even if I hadn't been born in Iran, the Iranian government considers me an Iranian. And even though I have American citizenship, Iran does not recognize dual citizenship, so I have to travel to Iran on an Iranian passport. That also meant that my wife is automatically eligible for Iranian citizenship, as is my son. So they also got their Iranian passports. A lot of paperwork back and forth. But it, in the end, it wasn't too difficult. And so once we arrived in Iran, we were arriving as Iranian citizens. So that's something that I think pretty much every Iranian American has gone through in terms of even wanting to just visit for a couple of weeks and see the country or see family if they have family there.
So as to the attention that you attracted, you had certainly written things in the past that they weren't that they were not pleased about.
Yes, I've been interrogated before. I think my cell phone number, I've maintained an Iranian cell phone number since 2008, I think, just because our American cells or European cells don't work in Iran because of the sanctions. Again, there's no way for the Iranian mobile company to have an agreement with an American mobile company. So you have to have an Iranian cell, and if you want to have a cell phone in Iran, and I've maintained that phone, and I believe it's I know it's tapped and it's monitored, and I've received phone calls on it from curious people, I'd say, who don't identify themselves and are from the, I assume, from the Ministry of Intelligence. Every reporter, anybody who has ever written an article on Iran, particularly those who have written from Iran, who have reported from Iran with a press pass, will have a file. I saw my file one time I was, well, at least I saw the thickness of my file the one time I was interrogated for 3 hours by a good cop, bad cop, who I called bad cop and worse cop. It's quite a thing. I mean, almost everything, I assume everything that I'd ever written was in that file because it was, you know, a few inches thick. They were going through various things I'd written. And why did you say this? Why did you say that? Do you really believe that? Do you really believe this? All those kinds of things. So they were going to monitor me. I had told them after that interrogation, which was only a couple of months before moved to Iran with my family, that I was going to come back to Iran, but I was not going to be working. So would I be okay? And they said, as long as you don't work. And I've been refused, actually, a press pass since the Green Movement of 2009. Mm. So I can't actually work in Iran right now. I don't know if I can, if I go back and ask for a press pass, if things have changed to the extent that they would issue me a press pass. But so far, no, I haven't been able to get a press pass. But if I, you know, I really didn't get involved in any kind of political activity, and I certainly wasn't going to write from Iran because that would immediately attract attention, and I would be actually breaking the law if I did that because I didn't have a press pass.
You were writing, you just weren't publishing.
Exactly. That's what I meant. Yes. Yeah. Yes. Well, I was writing. I was, certainly taking notes and copious notes and writing certain things. But yes, not publishing, not sending any material out of Iran, even via email or anything. Yeah.
We're speaking this hour with journalist Houman Majd. His book, The Ministry of Guidance Invites You to Not Stay, is available now in paperback. If you'd like to join our conversation, you can call us at 1-800-933-5372 or email think@kera.org.
Thank you.
Funding for Think is made possible by SMU Continuing and Professional Education, with courses in art, literature, history, communication, photography, and Portuguese. Fall registration is now open. Registration and information at smu.edu/CAPE.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. We're speaking this hour with author Hooman Majd. His book, The Ministry of Guidance Invites You to Not Stay, An American Family in Iran, is out now in a paperback edition. If you'd like to join the conversation, you can call 1-800-933-5372 or email think@kera.org. You can also send me a tweet at Chris Boyd Think. Early in the book, Hooman, you write about your fascination with the Iranian national sense that life is shameful. Can you talk about how that philosophy plays into the way that Iranians really do live and understand themselves and their place in the world?
Well, it's very complex. I mean, there's so many cultural aspects to Iran and Iranians that are difficult to understand. Part of it is based on Shia Islam and the martyr complex that Iranians have, and the idea that this life is meant to be a struggle and difficult and almost shameful, and you're preparing yourself for the next life. And of course, you know, they have the history of their saints who died struggling against injustice, and the injustice will always be there until the missing imam, for those who are religious, appears back on earth to bring justice to the world. So part of it is the Shia concept, and the other part is just it's an Iranian, in some ways, an Iranian, a purely Iranian cultural aspect that people do feel that, overall, without even saying it, that there's something shameful about human existence, and it's one is better off to think about the afterlife than life on this planet. It's understandable if you're an Iranian. It's a very difficult concept to get across, though. But it does affect the way people behave. It does affect the way people, the government behaves, I think, especially those who are less westernized. And, you know, in the old days when Iran had a Shah and a monarchy and the monarchy believed in westernization and moving forward and being modern, many Iranians followed suit. More secular Iranians did and took on Western culture in many ways. And the people who succeeded in the revolution and the revolutionaries who are still in power in Iran tend to be Iranians who never accepted that, never accepted the westernization, and haven't traveled as much and haven't experienced the West as much, and therefore are very Iranian in the sense that they haven't had the exposure that that some of the more secular Iranians have had. So it affects their behavior, and one sees it all the time among Iranians.
What role does religious observance play in everyday life? And you know, so many Americans have such a hard time conceiving of life in a country where people are practicing Islam. And yet in this country, everyone's sort of resigned to the fact or accepting of the fact that this is a largely Christian country, and that doesn't seem so foreign to us. Can you help us understand it even in comparison to the way America is largely a Christian nation in terms of the majority of people's practice?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's actually not that dissimilar. You will find, particularly in places in the South or in Texas, your state, you would see some similarities in the way religion, or at least the way people would like religion to be part of their everyday life, more part of everyday life than it is today. America is a purely secular country, at least when it comes to government and society. In Iran, I mean, Islam is alien only because it's a faith that we don't have too much experience with. And Muslims in America have traditionally been quiet, although there are plenty of American Muslims. But they tend to be, not showing off their faith too much outside of the very big cities like New York City or Chicago or places like that. People might be aware that there's a mosque down the street somewhere, but Muslims are a little bit shy of showing their faith too much, particularly post 9/11. I mean, the whole thing about the mosque, downtown mosque in New York, is a perfect example of that. But life, Iranians are used to it. The Iranians who who've lived in Iran and have spent the last 35 years under an Islamic regime are used to the strictures that are there because of an Islamic government and an Islamic society. In other words, the women who have to cover their hair, for example, or even men and the dress code. You can't wear shorts, for example, even though it's 110 degrees outside. You have to wear long pants. And short sleeve shirts for men were even banned until 10-15 years ago. So people are aware of that. I mean, a husband and wife can hold hands walking down the street, but they probably shouldn't be kissing each other. If they do, if they're caught, they could get into trouble. And certainly, unmarried couples shouldn't. But I think you'd find those attitudes would be attitudes that maybe some Americans would share, particularly fundamentalist Christians would share in terms of public behavior and adherence to one's faith. Obviously, alcohol is forbidden because under Islam it's forbidden. But many people drink alcohol, and many people do it. Many other things that are illegal, for example, having girlfriends or boyfriends, or going on dates. I mean, you see it all the time, and the government doesn't always crack down too harshly on this because they know that these things are impossible to police. On a large scale, although they will from time to time, and especially in the summer months when women tend to dress a little bit more loosely, they do tend to crack down and try to have roadblocks and stuff like that. Or if you're going north to the shore, the Caspian Sea, which is a popular weekend destination for people from Tehran, there's roadblocks to make sure that couples in a car are indeed couples or brother and sister are related somehow, and you don't have strange women and strange men cavorting about the seashore. So you do see those things, but Iranians have ways of getting around that, and they don't seem to be as concerned about it, or the ones who've lived there for a long time and have gotten used to that system don't seem to be too concerned about it. And the alcohol thing, I'll just compare it to prohibition in the United States. I mean, people drank. And, people who wanted to drink, drank, and people who didn't, who believed that prohibition was the right thing, didn't. And in Iran, it's the same thing.
With regard to modesty in dress, if you are somehow caught on the street during one of these crackdowns, what happens?
Well, generally speaking, you get a warning. I've seen women, arguing and fighting back, but they can take you to jail and fine you. The fine can be around $100. Technically speaking, you can even be, according to Islamic law, be lashed, but I don't think that's happened in years and years. Generally speaking, it's a warning. Women will not go out on the street without a scarf, and you can be stopped for your scarf being too high on your head, too much hair showing, and usually most women will just adjust their scarf when they're accosted by the female morality police and told to adjust their scarves. They will. Occasionally, one of them will start shouting and yelling at telling the police to mind their own business. They're quite actually brave, I found, far more brave than I am in terms of dealing with the police. But I guess, again, that's one thing that the people who live there are used to and know the system. Some people have been stopped in their cars for their scarves, like falling off their heads or stuff like that. And again, usually it's a fine or more often than not, it's just a warning.
Talk about the climate in which reformist thinkers and politicians are operating, and the ability of people who disagree with government policies to actually express that.
Well, Iran is interesting. I mean, there's actually a lot more relatively open discussion and relatively open media criticism of the government. There are red lines that cannot be crossed, and those who cross those lines get into serious trouble. One of the red lines is criticizing Islam itself, and that will obviously get you behind bars and your newspaper or the outlet that you published in shut down, or if you even do it in any kind of public gathering. The other red line is criticizing the what they call the Nizam, the system, which is what we would call the regime, the Islamic system. If you criticize that system, that's another red line. But you are reasonably free to criticize government officials, the administration. When I say reasonably free, with certain limits, under President Ahmadinejad, things were a little tougher. He was someone who had a relatively thin skin, and if you criticize the president, they would arrest you or try to arrest you in some cases and accuse you of insulting an official of the Islamic Republic, which is, I think, they can do. But generally speaking, people have been pretty open about criticizing, and you see it now with the reformist president, or at least the moderate president, Hassan Rouhani. There is a tremendous amount of criticism of him and his administration from all sides. Even some progressives are criticizing him for not doing enough. And we saw that with Khatami. When the hardliners are in power, there tends to be less criticism. They tend to be much more strict. Yeah, I mean, there's quite a lot of political dialogue going on. Compared to countries like Saudi Arabia or many of our other allies in the region, Iran has a relatively open political discourse. That said, there are areas that get you into trouble. And going back to what you were asking me earlier about the attention that a journalist draws, I mean, everybody's aware that there's right now an American citizen, the Washington Post reporter in Iran, who I know quite well, Jason Rezaian, and his wife, who have been arrested and haven't been charged yet. Nobody knows where they are. And who knows why they were arrested. Nobody said anything. The judiciary in Iran has said that they're being interrogated and they're in an investigation stage. We don't know what that means. But in Iran, sometimes it's hard to know what anything means. I mean, even myself, when I was in Iran, knowing that I was under observation, I'm not saying I was being followed by men in cars or anything like that, but under general observation, you just never knew. You could be having tea with someone, and that someone could have been someone who was of interest to the intelligence services, and then you automatically become a suspect. And sometimes one has to be careful not to be too careful either, because if you're too careful, then it becomes suspicious itself. Why are you being so careful? Could you be a spy if you're being so careful? So I drank in Iran. I assume that they know that I drink. I've written about it in the past in my first book, and they'd read my first book. So if I suddenly stopped drinking, that in itself would be suspicious, in my mind anyway.
So it was for your personal safety.
Yeah. So I had to drink every night. Yes. I had to drink. I had to use a VPN, which is technically illegal, a virtual private network for accessing the internet, freely accessing the internet and getting to censored sites. If I didn't, I think that would be suspicious. It would be, what, is he suddenly converted to Shia Islam in the strictest sense? I mean, they wouldn't believe that. Mm. So sometimes it's hard to know what exactly one should do. And in the case of Jason, I'm 100% sure he's not guilty of anything. He may have had, as I said, he's a journalist living in Iran, writing for the Washington Post, an Iranian-American whose mother is American, father was Iranian, and was born and raised in California, started going to Iran in his 20s, not even as a child. And I think that as a journalist, he's probably met with many people, and some of those people could have been suspicious characters and somehow he's gotten caught up in it. So it's a very difficult thing to know exactly how to behave and what could or couldn't get you into trouble. Of course, with Jason, I'm very hopeful, given that he hasn't been charged with any crime or with spying or anything like that, that he'll be released soon, I hope.
Many Americans are aware that Iranians draw a distinction between American people and culture and the policies of the United States government. But I'm curious as to what you learned about how accurately Iranians picture life in the United States if they have never been here.
I think those who have never been here, or at least have never even been to Europe, don't really know very much and make assumptions and in some cases might believe propaganda that is put out by the Iranian state about life in America. I mean, I think Ferguson's probably a very good example for America, for Iranians who've never been to America or have never been to Western Europe. They're probably believing that blacks in America are unable to walk down the street without being accosted by the police. So I think that, you know, that kind of image is probably depends on who you're talking to. I think generally speaking, even the most sophisticated Iranian has a somewhat negative view of American foreign policy, and understandably so if you're from that region to some degree. But in terms of life in America, I mean, even the most religious Iranians, their families have satellite TV, and they see life. They see documentaries. They see TV programs. They do believe there's a tremendous amount of sex going on in the United States, probably more than there actually is. And that's what they're told by the Iranian state. And I guess if you see some of our TV programs, you would be right to assume that. But generally speaking, they do have an idea of life in the United States, and they do see criticism of an open political system, criticism of the government. And those who haven't visited the United States are sometimes surprised by the things they hear. For example, I mean, just a quick example is when I was in Iran in 2008, I couldn't find a single person, including very sophisticated Iranians who had lived even in the United States, who could believe that it was possible for a black person to become president of the United States. I mean, they just didn't believe. They said, it's not going to happen. No one's going to allow that to happen. And I tried to explain that, no, actually, it can happen. And as I said, very sophisticated people were saying, no, you're crazy. It's not going to happen. It's never going to happen. So it's hard to say exactly how people view America, but I think in general, the Iranian population isn't as aware of life in America as one would hope them to be, and vice versa. Of course, and Americans aren't aware of Iranians, which is a great shame because there's actually quite a bit of commonality.
One of the things that causes Americans to sort of tense up is this idea that everyone in Iran is marching around, or was, you know, years ago, shouting death to America. Was that distinction between U.S. foreign policy and the American people understood in Iran when those sorts of demonstrations were happening?
I think Iranians are surprised when Americans get upset about the death to America chants. I mean, first of all, there are far fewer now than there were at the beginning of the revolution, when we saw the hostage crisis and we saw, you know, crazy bearded men screaming and ripping up American flags or burning them. You barely see the death to America. Friday prayers in Tehran. Now, Tehran's a city of almost 15 million people. And we always hear about Friday prayers. It's the big day. It's, you know, the big day of it's the Muslim holiday, Muslim Sabbath. And it's the one day a week you might go to mosque and sit in Friday prayers. And there's a Friday prayer leader, and he's an Ayatollah usually, and he will shout death to America at the end. But it's important to remember that in a city of 15 million people, the entire congregation in Tehran fits into probably less than a basketball arena. So it's not a huge number of people who are going to Friday prayers and shouting death to America, even the most, you know, anti-American people. And the Iranians think it's, you know, it should be clear. Of course we don't mean the American people. Of course we don't want death for the American people. It's just death to that system, death to that imperialist, colonialist foreign policy of the American government.
We're talking to journalist Houman Majd about his book, The Ministry of Guidance Invites You to Not Stay, An American Family in Iran. We'll resume the conversation in a moment. You can join us at 1-800-933-5372.
Funding for Think is made possible by SMU Continuing and Professional Education, with courses in art, literature, history, communication, photography, and Portuguese. Fall registration is now open. Registration and information at smu.edu/CAPE.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. We're speaking this hour with journalist Houman Majd. His new book is called The Ministry of Guidance Invites You to Not Stay, An American Family in Iran. It's just been released in a paperback edition. You can join us at 1-800-933-5372. And that's where we find Ali in Arlington. Hi, Ali.
Hey, how you doing?
Great, thank you.
I'd like to talk to your guest, Houman. I kind of have a similar case to him. I'm originally from Iraq. I was born in Iran, and then I moved to the U.S. With my parents. My question is, my understanding of Shia Islam is that it's a theoretical religion, especially before 1979, before the Iranian Revolution. My understanding of Shia Islam is that they claim that it's like the religion that can bring justice to the world. Now, when they had the chance to apply that religion, when the Iranian government embraced that after 1979, do you think that they did actually embrace and apply the actual Shia Islam, I mean, your understanding of it, your understanding of Shia Islam and your understanding of how the Iranian government work, or they had to change things around to make it work?
What do you think, Uman?
It's a difficult question. I mean, within Shia Islam, even among the grand ayatollahs, the highest rank you can be as a cleric, the equivalent of a pope, really, for Shia Muslims, there's a disagreement as to whether Shia Islam should be a political form, should take on a political form, whether society should be the clerics should be involved in the politics of a country or not. And Ayatollah Khomeini was one who believed it should. Ayatollah Sistani, who today is the grand ayatollah in Iraq, believes that it shouldn't, that it should be a guide for people, not a political system. I'm not an expert in Shia Islam by any stretch of the imagination, and do I believe that it's been applied? Certainly the Iranian ayatollahs, the Iranian clerics who have since 1979 ruled Iran, believe that it has, and they believe their interpretation of Shia Islam is the correct interpretation. But as with every religion and every branch and every sect, there are different interpretations, and there will be people even inside Iran, even ayatollahs inside Iran, who disagree and believe that it hasn't been. Classic case is Ayatollah Montazeri, who died 3 years ago, but was supposed to be the successor to Ayatollah Khomeini, but fell out with him before Khomeini died, and over the interpretation of how Shia Islam should be, what an Islamic republic should be. And he was kept under house arrest for many years, but he was a very, very senior ayatollah. And as I said, he supported the Green Movement, and then he died, I think it was in 2010. At any rate, even within Iran, even among the clerics, there will be a disagreement. So I'm certainly am no place to judge whether Shia Islam, the correct Shia Islam, has been applied in Iran or not. Certainly the people who have ruled Iran and have governed Iran over the last 35 years believe it has, and with obviously some critics inside Iran and obviously outside of Iran too.
When Americans are upset, we tend to be very vocal about it, right? We talk about our feelings, we shout, we blog. Iranians, you tell us, are given to sulking. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Yes, well, that's one. That's a form of emotional expression, I guess. Sulking, yes. Iranians have we're known for a number of things, but sulking is definitely one of them. It's meant to send a signal to whoever it's directed at, and if it's a political sulk, it's very public. It's hard to describe what it means, although it's sort of this, like, it goes back to that martyr thing I was talking about earlier. Mm-hmm. I'm the martyr. I've done everything I can to, you know, help, whether it's my family or my country, and now you accuse me, and I'm being victimized here, and as such, I just refuse to do whatever it is you refuse to do. And it becomes a very kind of like a strong emotional position that you take, and it's supposed to make the other side feel bad and kind of beg you to come back to work if it is, or beg you to come back to the family if it's a family situation. It's a very common trait of Iranians, and it unfortunately extends to politics. As you were saying about Americans being emotional, so our politicians can be emotional, but they rarely sulk. You don't see Obama, when he's very unhappy, say, I'm not coming to work tomorrow. You know? You better come and beg me to come to work, because without me, you're much worse off than you are with me. But that's the kind of signal that Iranians like to send when they sulk. And it's true in interpersonal relationships, and it's true, of course, in politics. And in the book, I devote a whole chapter to this, partly because Ahmadinejad, the previous president, went on this giant sulk, a 12-day sulk, which sort of like brought the country to a halt politically anyway. I think that in his particular case, he kind of lost that sulk. He wasn't begged to come back to work. And I think he realized that his sulk wasn't working. At that point, though, he had become quite unpopular, not just among reformists, but even among hardliners and conservatives. So I think he misjudged how popular he may have been. I think he may have actually thought that he did indeed win 66% of the votes in 2009 and was tremendously popular. And I think the sulk actually showed him that he wasn't. Had he been very popular, had he been truly a popular figure in Iran, particularly post-2009, the sulk may have worked. And some people argue that when Khatami, the reformist president who preceded him, whenever he was being attacked and whenever he wasn't able to get his way, had he gone into a sulk, with the support of the people, he might have actually won in quotation marks, that particular Salk, and they may have been forced to change things to his liking in order to get him to come back to work. So, yeah, that's just part of the culture. We believe in Salks, and we believe in conspiracy theories.
Was there anything about this time that you spent there for a year that helped you understand your family in a way that you hadn't before?
I think so. I mean, I grew closer to them, having not grown up with them.
Yeah,
I definitely grew closer. I think I did understand them more. I mean, my family, the family that have stayed in Iran, were revolutionaries, for the most part. You know, like some other Iranian families, we had, you know, people on both sides of the political fence. My father obviously worked for the Shah, and then many of his family were revolutionaries, and some of them were clerics. And Khatami is one example, former President Khatami. But I think I did, yes, I think I grew closer to them, understood their, I understood why they, despite in some cases being very successful and quite wealthy and having thrived under the Islamic Republic, why they chose to live their lives in the Islamic, even those who weren't political, even those who weren't revolutionaries among my family, why they have this love of the country and why they like living there, even though they've traveled abroad and have had opportunities to leave and settle somewhere else, why they insist on remaining in their country of birth. And I think that's it kind of makes me a little jealous.
What are the most significant changes in Iran under President Rouhani?
Well, I think it's hard to say. I've been back twice for only a couple of days at a time with NBC News because I'm a contributor to NBC News and I've worked with them in Iran. So I haven't spent a lot of time under Rouhani. I know many of the characters who were sidelined during the Ahmadinejad administration. I would see them actually in Tehran when they were basically unemployable under Ahmadinejad after 2009, certainly. And I think the changes that are obvious, you know, human rights groups argue that, well, there hasn't been any change in human rights or in freedoms because there are people in prison for political opinion and there's execution still going on. And that's, you know, certainly true. But I think the society is more open, and people I talk to and even my own experience in 2013 going there after his election, you sensed a certain optimism and people felt freer, even if they necessarily weren't freer, but they felt freer. You do see a lot more, more newspapers have opened, more people feel comfortable in expressing their opinion. I think, and of course, then the economy has improved somewhat, partly because of this nuclear deal, or at least the provisional nuclear deal that was signed, the temporary deal that was signed last year. So there has been, inflation has come down a bit, and there's some optimism. And I think optimism is really probably the only thing you can really put your finger on, the optimism that things can get better if Rouhani is allowed to continue his program. And that affects people's moods and it affects society and in some ways it's quite visible if you're in Iran. But in terms of significant changes, I don't think the kind of changes that some people were hoping for, you don't really see that in the same way. And I'll compare it again to progressives being disappointed with President Obama, people who voted for him thinking there would be these huge changes in American society, which haven't come about for many people. You know, something as simple as closing Guantanamo, which is something he wanted to do, and progressives said he should do and voted for him in order for him to be able to do. Our progressives are disappointed in that. Drone attacks, that's just foreign policy, but even domestic policy, people have been disappointed. And I think there's some of that in Iran, but it's early in the Rouhani presidency, and so I think there's still a lot of hope.
Does he potentially make any changes or reforms at the pleasure of the supreme leader? Can you give us some sense of the complexities of that relationship?
I think all reforms or all changes are at the pleasure of the supreme leader. Mm-hmm. I think if the supreme leader doesn't want something, is absolutely adamantly against it, it won't happen. But the supreme leader doesn't rule in the way a traditional, in the way we think of a dictator ruling and saying, this is my absolute word. He is the supreme leader of the Islamic revolution. And that's telling in itself. He's not the supreme leader of Iran. He's the leader of the revolution. He's there to protect the revolution. So Iran is still an ideological state and still a revolutionary state. And in protecting the revolution, he still does listen to all sides, all political sides inside Iran, including reformists. Even after 2009, he did. And he will take advice and he will weigh things and he will see what's good, what he believes is good for the revolution and what he believes is good for the country. So there can be reforms. He can be persuaded and has been persuaded in the past. But he has to be persuaded. There's no question about that. And on foreign policy, it's the same thing. He has to be persuaded. He has to be persuaded that it's right to talk to America. He had to be persuaded that it was okay for or good for President Rouhani to speak with President Obama last year at the UN, on the phone anyway. And so, yes, it is at the pleasure of the supreme leader, although he is malleable. He is not an absolute dictator in the way that we sometimes think of dictators or authoritarian regimes such as North Korea or Cuba, where it's really one man making all the decisions. Usually the day-to-day running of the country is left, certainly in the economic realm and other realms, is left to the administration and to parliament, which is the equivalent of our Congress. And some larger issues of reform might come to the attention of the supreme leader, and he has to make a judgment whether he will either allow them or allow a slower movement towards those reforms. But we have seen the supreme leader change his mind or move in one direction over the other in the past, and I think that's where many of Rouhani's supporters are hopeful, because Rouhani has a very good relationship with the supreme leader and has been his friend and comrade over the past 35 years. And if anybody can persuade him, it's Hassan Rouhani.
Did your year in Tehran change your identity as Iranian-American or American-Iranian or citizen of the world? How did you leave? Were you different than when you had arrived there?
I think yes, probably. I definitely, when I was there, I certainly felt Iranian. And in day-to-day life, I felt very Iranian. I mean, that would be sometimes, I'd have a little bit of a culture shock if I was out all day alone doing things or whatever and meeting with Iranians and then coming home and suddenly I'm speaking English again, an American wife, and, you know, getting back on the internet and suddenly I'm back in New York. But yes, I think the identity, the Iranian identity, strengthened for me in Iran. The longer I'm away from it, though, and when I'm in America, even if I've just returned from Iran, I still feel very American. And I think that fades. The Iranian identity fades somewhat as you just engage in your daily life. As a writer and a journalist, though, and particularly since I've written many things about Iran, most of my journalism has been about Iran, I'm always pulled back. So the fading isn't going to be too long. But yes, I think that having spent that time as an adult living there, I think I feel more Iranian, yes.
You hope your son might want to do the same?
Well, yes, one would hope so. At least from a cultural perspective, I wouldn't like him to go into politics or get politically involved in any way. But I think culturally, I think I would like him to be curious about that side of him. And I think what's actually interesting, I've noticed among Iranian Americans what you brought up at the beginning of the program about Iranian Americans who are immigrants, who in general, not just Iranians, but among the Iranian Americans, I've noticed that this desire to understand their roots is actually quite strong. And you see many of Iranian Americans who actually never even been to Iran because they were born and raised here over the last 30 years or so, wanting to, you know, get their Iranian passports, go there, spend summer vacation there, go visit their grandmother, go visit their cousins.
Got to jump in here. We're out of time. Yeah. The book by Houman Majd is The Ministry of Guidance Invites You to Not Stay, an American Family in Iran. Houman, it's been a great pleasure. Thank you so much for making time for us.
Oh, my pleasure. Thank you. It's been great.
Think is produced by Stephen Becker and engineered by Shelley Canavy. Lindsay Connect is assistant producer with help on the phones today from Addie Sun. Our executive producer is Jeff Whittington. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening and have a great day.